Hello, it's Thursday, 4th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson. On today's show, Gary Bauman and I will be rounding up the top eight travel and tourism talking points from March. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, we've completed the first quarter of 2024. I have no idea where that went to. March was another frenetic month with plenty of travel and tourism news, statistics, announcements, and pronouncements. So where is Southeast Asia at? Exactly 2 years after much of the region began to reopen its borders after the pandemic. Hannah and I have put together a list of March's top eight talking points, which take us to Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Cambodia, Indonesia, the Philippines, and China. So Hannah, where shall we start?
Well, we can't do an episode without talking about Thailand, can we? So we might as well put them up front, put them at the top. And of course, there's always loads of moves. You know, as we were saying the other day, Gary, they seem to be opening every door possible to them to, you know, in a bid to boost tourism numbers. So this month has seen two big changes around legislation, and that's around marriage equality and around casinos. Gary, maybe you can tell us a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, these are significant changes. They're not just about tourism, really. They're about societal change. So should we start with marriage equality? And we did discuss this a little while ago, Hannah, in terms of how this actually might, you know, change aspects of its tourism industry. The first draft of the marriage equality bill, which would make Thailand the first country in Southeast Asia to legalize same-sex unions, went through the lower house of the parliament. I think that was a couple of weeks ago. This week on April the 2nd, it passed the first reading in the Senate, which is quite significant when you look at the numbers of the vote in the Senate. 147 Thai senators voted in favor, only four against and seven abstaining. So this is kind of cruising through. It actually has to go through a longer period, though. It's not actually going to become law potentially until later in the year. Having gone through the first reading, it has to go through what is called a Senate vetting committee. Once that is completed, there may be some slight amendments which would have to go through a second and a third reading. If it passes either of those, it would then go to royal assent to the king. And then there will be a 120-day moratorium before it would actually become law. So you're probably looking at the back end of this year. But, you know, it is a really big societal change.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, it is so exciting, I think, to see that. And I think to see the approval levels, like you say, Gary, in the Senate, in Parliament as well, it's just been really overwhelmingly for this change. And it will be super interesting, won't it, to see, you know, when it does come in on. You're quite right, this isn't, you know, this is about societal change, but it will be really interesting to see the impact that that has on the tourism industry, on the wedding industry, even for Thailand longer term. So yeah, huge shift. And I still remember when you asked me a few months ago, like, what are the other countries in Asia who've legalized same-sex marriage? And it was Taiwan and Nepal. So everybody remember that Nepal one. That's an unexpected one, but it's there, and hopefully soon Thailand.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other significant potential change is the legalization of casino gaming, which is law in several countries in Southeast Asia now. And that was primarily, you remember, Singapore is the famous one where it changed its legislation, changed its law to open up the two integrated resorts. That was back at the end of the 2000s, I think those two integrated resorts opened in 2010. Thailand wants to go down the same route. That last week, the prime minister said that he was in favor of doing so. There is quite a lot of illegal gaming in Thailand, and actually bringing it legally would then set it on a path to open up what would be similar integrated resorts to Macau or to Singapore. This goes before Thai cabinet next week. A report has been put together about the potential economic value of this. Obviously, the statistics are huge. Whether they're actually real is another issue. But it's already being talked that, you know, some of the big players that are in Macau, such as MGM from the US, Galaxy from Macau, Genting from Malaysia, would be interested to get involved in Thailand. Obviously, these resorts will be huge undertakings, financial undertakings. I think there's going to be a minimum limit of 100 billion Thai baht, which is about $2.73 billion US dollars. Obviously, it's going to take time to build those, but it looks like this is actually going to become law relatively soon, I would think.
Yeah, and it would be really interesting to see how this then impacts on the region. And of course, you know, we've seen Philippines came out, I think, earlier in the month or last month saying that they wanted to compete with Singapore in terms of that casino revenue, and they believe they're actually going to surpass Singapore. And, you know, what we've been saying about Cambodia for the longest time and their, you know, post-pandemic recovery is that we have seen a lot of land border crossings from Thailand into Cambodia. And when you speak to a lot of the local tourism stakeholders in Cambodia, they talk about, well, actually, maybe a lot of them are here to do gaming. So it would be interesting to see how those arrivals into Cambodia, if Thailand allows domestic tourists to gamble, which of course may not be the case, but it would be really fascinating to see how that is impacted when it comes in.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the big question really for other destinations around the region is whether this is actually going to create new demand or whether it's actually going to cannibalize existing demand. Obviously, I would say another element to this is the fact that the new resorts will build huge venues, huge indoor stadiums, which again will really tap into that concert tourism thing that we're talking about all the time in the region at the moment. It would give new venues for international acts and Asian acts to perform at.
Yeah, so potentially a real game changer. So moving on from Thailand, and let's go to Bali and revisit, I think it's probably our February story, really, which was about the Bali tourism tax and that it was implemented on the 14th of February. To remind you, it's about 150,000 Indonesian rupiah. What's that in USD, Gary? You know, about 30 USD, something about like that, I think. So it's not a huge amount, but still significant, still something that tourists have to do before they come in. And we had a great podcast episode with the Bali Hotels Association kind of talking us around that implementation of it. Now, the implementation itself seemed to be fairly smooth, but what Sandiaga Uno, the tourism minister in Indonesia, reported last week was that they estimate only around 40% of international tourists have paid that fee since the regulation came into effect. 40% seems fairly low, but then he kind of explains that they've been mainly focusing on capturing that fee for people who've arrived directly into Bali through those international gates. What they haven't really been doing is, you know, tapping into or being able to more strictly enforce, I suppose, those arrivals who are coming from domestic destinations. So who've flown into Jakarta first and then are transiting to Bali, for example. So they are looking at placing more fee collection booths at those domestic arrival routes. And, you know, they've even been going out and doing spot checks at top tourism sites in Bali. So, for example, at Uluwatu, they've been, you know, spot checking the foreign tourists. Have they paid this fee, this tourism tax, or not? And they can pay it via the app if they haven't. So there's clearly this drive to do it, but it's interesting because it just shows that it is not a really quick, easy thing to implement this kind of tourism tax.
Oh, it's quite a remarkable story. 40% is incredibly low. And you said, you know, the actual implementation was fairly smooth. Fairly smooth because there's so many leakages, it seems. It's astonishing, really, that they have to actually go out around the destination around and collect it from people on beaches or bars or whatever, because you can't collect it in the airport.
Yeah, agreed. It is a strange concept, right? And imagine you're having a nice time in Uluwatu, about to go around one of the temples, and then suddenly this officer approaches you and wants to check if you've paid this tourism tax or not. Maybe not an ideal holiday.
Maybe not. So let's move on to Singapore, Hannah. And the Singapore Tourism Board has launched a new mice campaign. We don't talk about mice actually that much. It's going really big with its tourism promotion. It's calling Singapore the world's best mice city. That's a big claim, right?
It sure is, isn't it? World's best mice city. Maybe not mice country, but they're city country. I mean, they're going big. And I find what was also interesting is in the same week, they had a lot of press around how they're supporting GSTC's mice sustainability guidelines as well. So what I really feel is that Singapore is trying to gear up to be this destination that is positioning itself as a sustainable MICE destination, which is not a bad idea, you know, particularly if you're looking at the longer haul markets. And I think we've talked about this before, you know, from Europe, from North America, there really is this scrutiny for these kind of MICE events on how sustainable they are. And if Singapore can go out there and show that we have these guidelines and our suppliers adhere to these guidelines, and we've got basically this whole ecosystem that is supporting sustainable MICE, it's a great story, right? It's going to be something that wins and inspires confidence and wins them bids. Whether it's so sustainable to fly people halfway across the world to Singapore for that MICE event is of course something else.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I noticed that this campaign of the world's best MICE city is part of six global initiatives that Singapore's going to put together, which is aimed at redefining the narrative around Singapore as a premier destination. I think that's quite interesting because that really shows that it's going to target this kind of blended travel, you know, this crossover between business and leisure travel. Perhaps it's recognized that, you know, there will be challenges ahead of just attracting pure leisure travelers and pure business travelers, perhaps, you know, you're trying to combine the two and just maximize the opportunities that Singapore has as a small destination, but one that obviously punches well above its weight. It has great MICE facilities. It has great MICE services. It has all the supporting infrastructure, doesn't it? It has great dining. It has great entertainment. It has great lifestyle. It's expensive, and that's one of the big challenges. But, you know, you can see that it actually can put on great shows. It hosts some of the region's best travel shows, as well as all sorts of different industry exhibitions and conventions, that kind of thing. And it's really promoting that. It sees a real window to gain leverage on some of the other big cities in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fascinating. I am looking forward to see what these other five initiatives are. They didn't talk about those, but yes, I noticed exactly this kind of high value. You get the idea, maybe more affluent travelers away from that mass tourism. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if one of the strong components within this is sustainability when they launch the other five.
Yeah, good point. So watch this space. So let's move on. And this is, I guess we've been kind of waiting for this to happen, haven't we, Hannah? Pre-pandemic levels are starting to be exceeded and those statistics just keep coming. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, so these are two, well, I suppose three different countries. So Vietnam, always super hot on their tourism arrival numbers. You know, on the 31st of March, they're already telling you what their March arrivals numbers were. So they announced that their Q1 arrivals had now surpassed 2019 levels for international arrivals. So they were 3% higher than 2019. So three, you might think that's a bit small, but I think it is really the only country, and I say that with a grain of salt because we don't yet have everybody else's tourism arrivals, but so far on paper, they're the first one to kind of do that. You know, if you're looking at their March numbers, it's just getting higher. So January and February, they were seeing about 1.5 million international arrivals. March inched a little bit more to 1.6 million. So they're growing. You know, I remember when we used to talk about them after it first opened. So, they're kind of the laggards, weren't they? They you know, not really sorted out their visa policies, and you know, it's such a shame. They've got a lot of potential. They seem to be kind of quietly delivering.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we're just going to see that flow throughout the year, aren't we? Of catch up back to 29 levels 5 years ago. Can you believe that 2019 was 5 years ago?
No. But I can't believe it's April either. So
that's very true.
And the other one, when we're looking at pre-pandemic levels, is the Malaysia-Singapore land border, which is, of course, it is one of the busiest land borders in the world. Kuala Lumpur to Singapore is one of the busiest air routes in the world. But it seems that they have now surpassed that daily border crossings. So Malaysia announced that pre-pandemic, that Johor-Singapore land border used to have around 400,000 average daily travelers. That's now about 430,000 to 450,000. And in fact, over the Easter weekend, the Good Friday, saw 510,000 travelers crossing the checkpoints. I mean, and this is both ways. You know, it is not just one way, all Singaporeans, 500,000 Singaporeans leaving Singapore over the weekend to get into Malaysia. But, you know, it is really testament to that recovery. And I can imagine also being very much driven by the fact that the ringgit is not performing very well against the Singapore dollar. And perhaps it well is a lot of Singaporeans flooding into Malaysia to do some cheap shopping.
Yeah, absolutely. And I read, I think this is on the top of my head, Hannah, isn't it going to be passport free leaving Singapore into Malaysia quite shortly? It'll be biometric verification rather than passport verification, which Singapore is going to introduce at the airport. But I think it was going to pilot that scheme at the land border between Singapore and Malaysia.
Well, I think they've already implemented a QR code for car travelers. And they've had to even remind passengers, like, please don't forget your passport. Please bring that along with you. You do still need it. But yeah, they have like these QR stickers, and I think you have to register in advance and just scan the QR sticker and away you go. Of course, that's only on one side. The other side, in Malaysia's side, you still definitely need to show your passport. And in fact, there have even been spot checks by the Malaysian authorities from higher up to check that, you know, these checkpoints are open, and making a big fuss if they're not, because they know that all these Singaporeans want to get into Malaysia and they want to make it as easy as possible.
So that's our first four major talking points from March in the bag. Number five, this is a blatant plug, really, Hannah. You mentioned there that we're starting to see, you know, this catch up in terms of statistical catch up with 2019. It's all about catching up both lost time and lost numbers. But at the same time, we're also seeing a lot of global trends reports, travel trends reports. You know, what are the new trends in travel? And the Amex 2024 Global Travel Trends Report was published in March as well. And Hannah, you and I appeared on the radio this week here in Malaysia, BFM, to discuss that. And particularly four of the key trends, which were interesting because those trends were posited as global trends. Now, the survey respondents to the Amex report were in several countries, but none of them were in Southeast Asia, although there were three mega markets, really, in Asia Pacific that were included. Those were China, India, and Japan. I think the other markets were the US, UK, Australia, Mexico, and Canada, I think. But no actual input from Southeast Asian travelers. But at the same point, you know, obviously some of those markets are key inbound source markets to Southeast Asia. So there is some overlap in terms of inbound, perhaps less so outbound. But what were those four key trends that we discussed, Hannah? What were our conclusions?
So they had For the Love of the Game. So that was very much all about sports tourism. Planning Big. So those are those kind of big expedition style, I guess, once in a lifetime type trips that people are taking. Going solo, traveling as a solo traveler, and on a whim, those kind of spontaneous trips. So it was interesting because, you know, some of them are more relevant to others. So For the Love of the Game, you know, I think we concluded that sports tourism definitely has a lot of pull for the region, although has not really been fully maximized yet. You know, we are not having the World Cups, for example, in Southeast Asia yet, but that there's clearly a big pull from sports fans to go see their favorite teams. Planning Big, that expedition style type tours. We were saying really that there's huge potential for that in Southeast Asia because, you know, it is such an adventurous place. We're talking about adventure travel. And, you know, I think I mentioned about Sabah and Sarawak in Malaysia, so that East Malaysia, and so many opportunities for that. You've got Mount Kinabalu, you've got all of these other opportunities to do these big trips. But the region, again, perhaps needs to get its act together a little bit and work together on that. Going solo, we see, yes, that stigma around solo travelers has been removed. And the last one that I think we were a little bit more hesitant around was on a whim, wasn't it, Gary?
Yeah, I think for a number of reasons. One, because there is a culture of travel around public holidays. You know, and life is very structured, of course. It's very difficult to just drop everything and just travel on a whim. You know, it's expensive. Travel has become more expensive. Even though flight prices are coming down, they're still much higher than they used to be. Average hotel rates are up. The cost of living when you're traveling is also up as well. And obviously, we're living in a pretty value-conscious region. So that one will be a little bit more difficult. I thought one of the interesting points, Hannah, you were saying there about the first trend, For the Love of the Game, which is about sports tourism, both sports events tourism and participative sports tourism. And you mentioned that obviously, as of yet, Southeast Asia hasn't managed to bag one of the major events like an Olympics or a World Cup. And then while we were in studio, there was actually a break for the news, wasn't there? And one of the news items was that Indonesia is actually thinking of putting together a bid for the 2036 Olympics, which was quite interesting timing.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, I mean, and of course, Singapore has the F1. So yes, we do have one of those major events here. But, you know, it's not sort of like a World Cup, an Olympics type thing. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun to actually record in a studio together with you, because what our listeners may not know is, although we are both in Malaysia, we very, very rarely ever record face-to-face, do we?
No, we used to before the pandemic, but then we got used to doing it remotely. And yeah, although we meet up and talk quite regularly, we don't actually record together very often. So yeah, it was great to be in studio. We'll put up a link on the show notes too, because it was a good discussion with Roshan Kennison of BFM. We had fun. It was a good laugh. It wasn't too serious. And we actually covered quite a lot of the region as well. We covered some of the other countries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So enough of our plugging, and on to the Philippines. And it's perhaps a relevant one, as we've just come out from Easter and we're going to be talking about the chocolate hills, although it is not quite such a light topic as Easter and just chocolate. So basically, there's been a big controversy. And this is, chocolate hills are in Bohol. It's a protected area of the Philippines. If you Google it, I think sometimes it's also called like the Teletubbies Hills. So it's like these round cones covered in beautiful green grass. And it started to come up kind of mid-month somehow that this Captain's Peak Garden and Resort had been basically developed allegedly without getting environmental compliance certificates. And there was a huge hoo-ha, basically, because it was, you know, being pointed out that this resort was here and nobody could really kind of answer who gave the authority or the permission for it to be built. So loads of finger pointing, everyone's blaming everyone, or they didn't have this permit, they didn't have that permit. I mean, of course, they got closed down pretty quickly, I think. Within the week, started investigating other resorts in that area as well to check if it's something similar was going on. But I think, you know, there's probably two big lessons from this. And one is that, you know, you really need to, as a destination, keep an eye on those protected areas and scrutinize that and make sure that there are no cracks. And I think this resort seemed to just kind of slip between the cracks, and certain authorities, presumed other authorities, had given them permissions, and it seems like they hadn't really. But the other thing that I think might be a good step that is coming out of this is, you know, the Department of Tourism is pushing to be included in the national government's Protected Area Management Board. I think that could only be a good thing. The Bohol provincial government is going to create a review and development committee to review investments and applications for resorts developments to check that they are part of that environmental law. And the Department of Tourism is going to be part of that committee too. So of course, whilst this is a really unfortunate incident, what I'm hoping is that it will then, you know, it's created a lot of awareness, basically, I think, in the Philippines right now about these developments in protected areas and how that shouldn't happen, and how can they address that and make sure that it doesn't happen in the future. So it is a bit of a bittersweet story.
Yeah. Well, nicely said, bittersweet chocolate hills. But it's quite interesting, I think, the point that you make, Hannah, that this actually was a protected area. And we're starting to see quite a lot of media reports now coming out about the lack of zoning when it comes to tourism developments in many destinations across the region. There's a TV program tonight on Channel News Asia about Bali and how much agricultural land is being lost there simply because there's no zoning. And applications to build properties, particularly for tourism, are just, you know, disregarding the agricultural land. And I think there was a quote that I saw on the TV this morning that said that 700 hectares of agricultural land per year is being lost in Bali. You know, once that's lost, it can't come back. But this, you know, this is across the region. We've seen some similar examples in Vietnam, every country, really. The interesting one, as you said, just going back to the initial point, is that this actually was a protected area in the Philippines. And that, I think, is what has caused the ire, because how did it get to develop this resort in an area of natural beauty, which actually does have some legal protection?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's all the finger pointing and everyone blaming everybody, but hopefully a more positive outcome comes out of that in the end.
Yeah, sure. So let's move on. That's six of our top eight talking points from March already covered. Number seven, now, Hannah, all the time now we're seeing new flight routes being announced across the region, crisscrossing Southeast Asia, crisscrossing Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, and of course, intercontinentally as well. You could pick any number of these as key stories, but one that I thought was quite interesting was that China Eastern, one of the big three airlines in China, has launched direct flights from Kunming, its first direct flight from Kunming in Southwest China to Kuala Lumpur. Now, again, surface-wise, that doesn't sound particularly interesting. Kunming is a leading second-tier city, so that brings inbound travel into Malaysia. You know, you're tapping into another relatively affluent second-tier city for visitors coming into Malaysia. But it's also a destination in its own right. And, you know, it has access to the beautiful landscapes of Yunnan province. So this one is quite interesting because it potentially has two-way tourism potential, particularly now as Malaysia and China have visa-free access inbound and outbound.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just this weekend, I was looking on my Facebook feed and I saw somebody in Yunnan province. So it's absolutely potential for both ways. And, you know, I think we were saying on BFM or somewhere else, I've lost track now. But when you were at Matar Fair, which is the big consumer travel fair in Malaysia, a couple of weeks ago, China was really the hot destination there. Everybody was selling China. And according to the agents, selling very, very well as well, because of the fact that it's visa free. So now it's given a little extra frisson of excitement because the fact that the UN is not performing as strongly against the ringgit as the USD or euro or Swiss franc or British pound. There's a lot going for outbound travel to China from the region right now. And yeah, it's exciting to see another link.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pauline Suhano from Astindo said the same, didn't she, after the Astindo travel fair from Indonesia. She said that China was a hot destination there. It doesn't have the same visa-free mutual rights yet as Malaysia does, but a hot destination amongst Indonesian travelers. And I think that's replicated in Singapore. I think that's replicated quite across the region now, that there is a demand to travel to China.
Yeah, absolutely.
That brings us to our final story, Hannah, which is really interesting for a number of reasons. One, because in our last podcast roundup, we kind of thought this story had gone a bit cold. And then a couple of days later, it became a hot story again.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is Air Asia Cambodia. So of course, last time on the podcast, we're not hearing anything more about Air Asia Cambodia. What's happening with that? Tony Fernandez, are you listening? Because literally a couple of days later, there was that announcement, Gary, that Air Asia Cambodia is going to launch very grand ambitions. They're going to transform the way people travel in Cambodia, according to the press release. The usual Air Asia dramatic style there. It's starting off pretty small. So they're starting off with two aircraft, two A320s, and they're going to fly between Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, and Sihanouk Phil. So very much focused on domestic routes for now. But it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people don't typically get around Cambodia flying domestically. They tend to take the bus. And so this could potentially truly change how people are getting around the country.
Yeah, you're right. And as you say, you know, AirAsia once again pressing the PR trigger, starting with two planes, as you said. After 5 years, it's hoping to have, it says, 60 aircraft. Purchasing 60 aircraft in 5 years at the moment is not easy given the backlogs, but that's what it wants to do. It's a joint venture with a hospitality group in Cambodia called Sivalai Asia. And as you said, Hannah, it's starting to launch as a domestic airline, but it will obviously offer connectivity for people that it can fly, that AirAsia can fly into Cambodia from neighboring countries. I think it's, about four or five countries in the region it flies directly to into Cambodia, and it wants to extend that to include Thailand, Singapore, and Vietnam later in the year. So, you know, it's going to be, although it's starting, as you said, starting small, it has this connective potential. And I guess for Cambodia, this is a real shot in the arm because it really needs more flight connections, doesn't it, particularly across the region?
Yeah, absolutely. So it could well help with international tourism, even if it's only domestic routes, because it could mean then that tourists might think, actually, it's a little bit easier for me to get around. I can, yes, I'm going to visit Angkor Wat in Siem Reap, but now I can get across to Phnom Penh as well and go check out their before I go on to somewhere else. So we might well see it could increase the duration actually of stay for people in, when they're coming to Cambodia.
Yeah, so that's a story that went cold and then came hot again, Hannah.
There we go. So with that, that brings the show to a close for this week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget, as always, to send us your thoughts and comments on anything we discussed or anything we missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, and as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and you can find us on any international podcast platform.
So that's a wrap for today. Gary's in Hong Kong next week, but I'll be back to talk more Southeast Asia travel and tourism with a special guest. See you then.